Well, I can't tell you how pleased I am to be here in Hungary. The last time I was in Budapest, there was still a red star atop the parliament building overlooking the Danube. And we as Christians had to meet in secret during that time. And it was such a difference between then and today. When we were here the last time, they were celebrating Soviet-Hungarian Brotherhood Day. And one of the Hungarians remarked to me, "Do you know why they call it Soviet-Hungarian Brotherhood Day instead of Soviet-Hungarian Friendship Day?" And I said, "No, why?" And he said, "Because you can choose your friends." So it's wonderful to see the fresh breath of freedom that exists now in this country. And of course, I am so excited to see what God is doing in Christian apologetics here in Europe. This sort of meeting and the movement that it represents is long overdue in Europe. And I am thrilled to be here to be a part of the genesis of what I hope will be a tremendous movement in the future that will just begin now and will increasingly gather momentum. Now, you'll notice that the talks that I'm going to be giving during the conference are somewhat different than the titles that were announced in the promotional literature. Those titles were selected by the organizers of the committee, not myself. And they struck me as rather self-important, and I didn't want to speak on those topics. So instead, I've chosen as my topic this morning, Advice to Christian Apologists. And I realize for those of you who are non-native English speakers how difficult it can be to listen to a talk in a foreign language. And so we've provided the text of the talk, and I hope you'll follow along. It's all complete right there, and that way you won't miss a word. Because what I have to share with you today deeply burdens my heart, and I think it's extremely important. In 1983, when Alvin Plantinga delivered his inaugural lecture as the John O'Brien Professor of Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, he chose as his topic, Advice to Christian Philosophers. Today I've chosen as my topic the related but somewhat narrower topic, Advice to Christian Apologists. More specifically, European Christian Apologists. Now, some of you might be thinking, well, who are you, an American, to be offering us advice? Plantinga faced a similar question and provided the best means of handling it. He replied, "That's a good question. I shall deal with it as one properly deals with good questions to which one doesn't know the answer. I shall ignore it. So too shall I. I only want to assure you, however, that the advice that I'm going to give, although pointed, springs out of a deep burden for Europe, and that I stand united with you in our common task. It's part of the purpose of this conference, or at least this track of the conference, to awaken a movement of Christian apologetics in Europe with a view toward reclaiming lost intellectual territory for Christ, to remold European intellectual life in such a way as to make the Christian Weltanschauung a viable intellectual alternative for educated men and women in Europe today. The task is daunting, indeed overwhelming. In fact, some people might say even hopeless. But given that we serve a God for whom nothing is impossible, and that this is the vision which inspires us, and that such is the task that is laid upon us, how shall we best go about it? Well, before we can answer that question, we need to have some grasp of the challenge facing us. In general, European culture is deeply post-Christian. It is the product of the Enlightenment, which introduced into European culture the leaven of secularism that by now has permeated the whole of society. The hallmark of the Enlightenment was free thought, that is to say, the pursuit of knowledge by means of unfettered human reason alone. Now, while it's by no means inevitable that such a pursuit must lead to non-Christian conclusions, and while most of the original Enlightenment thinkers were themselves theists, that is, believers in God, it's been the overwhelming impact of the Enlightenment mentality that European intellectuals do not consider theological knowledge to be possible. Theology is not a source of genuine knowledge, and therefore theology is not a Wissenschaft or a science. Reason and religion are at odds with each other. The picture of the world, which emerges from the genuine sciences, is a thoroughly naturalistic picture. The person who follows the pursuit of reason unflinchingly toward its end will be atheistic, or at least agnostic. In Eastern Europe, the Enlightenment secularism was reinforced by the Marxist critique of religion. Although Eastern Europeans remained largely skeptical of Marxism's positive account of man and society, after all, it's hard to believe in the virtues of the dictatorship of the proletariat when you have to wait 17 years to buy a miserable Trabant, still, they largely accepted the Marxist negative critique of religious belief, which was drilled into generations of school children by state indoctrinators. Those who refused to accept it were simply denied higher education, which in the end had the effect of imprisoning Christians in the uneducated lower class. Now, there have been countercurrents to Enlightenment rationalism in European thought. One thinks of Romanticism, for example. But these have been no more sympathetic to Christianity than the Enlightenment project. Indeed, they sometimes have served to offer a mystical, pantheistic nature religion as an alternative to traditional theism, in order that one's religious yearnings, which the Enlightenment rationalism tended to treat dismissively, might not go unfulfilled. On the current scene, self-proclaimed postmodernism is such a movement. The Enlightenment is associated with the modern age, dominated by science and technology, and hence is sometimes called modernity. Postmodernism rejects the all-sufficiency of human reason, championed by free thought. Now, this might seem at first blush a welcome development for Christian believers who are weary of centuries of attacks by Enlightenment rationalists. But in this case, the cure is worse than the disease. For postmodernists deny that there are universal standards of logic, rationality, and truth. And this denial is simply incompatible with the Christian idea of God, who is the creator and sustainer of all things, is an objectively existing reality, and who, as an omniscient being, has a privileged perspective on the world, grasping the world as it is in the unity of his intellect. And there is thus a unity and objectivity to truth which is simply incompatible with postmodernism. Postmodernists thus often see their task as implicitly anti-theological. For example, the literary critic Roland Barthes has written, and I quote, "To give a text an author is to impose a limit on that text, to furnish it with a final significance, to close the writing. In precisely this way, literature, by refusing to assign an ultimate meaning to the text and to the world as text, the world does not have a final meaning, literature liberates what may be called an anti-theological activity, an activity that is truly revolutionary, since to refuse to fix meaning is, in the end, to refuse God and his hypostases, reason, science, and law." And thus, postmodernism is no more friendly to Christian truth claims than was Enlightenment rationalism. Christianity is reduced to but one more voice in the cacophony of competing claims, none of which is objectively true. In any case, Enlightenment rationalism is so deeply embedded in European intellectual life that these anti-rationalistic currents, like Romanticism and postmodernism, are doomed, I think, to be mere passing fashions. And after all, nobody adopts a postmodernist view of literary texts when reading texts such as the labels on a medicine bottle or a box of rat poison. Clearly, we ignore the objective meaning of such texts at peril to our very lives. In the end, people turn out to be subjectivists only about ethics and religion, not about matters provable by science. But you see, that isn't postmodernism. That's nothing else than classic Enlightenment rationalism. It's just the old modernism all over again in a fashionable new guise. And thus the secularism originating in the Enlightenment shapes European life, and especially European academia. Although the overwhelming majority of Europeans retain a nominal affiliation with Christianity, only about 10% are practicing believers, and less than half of those are evangelical in their theology. The most significant trend in European religious affiliation is the growth of those classed as non-religious, from effectively 0% of the population in 1900 to over 22% today. Doubtless, the percentage of non-religious persons would be even higher among those in academic life. Now, I mention academic life because the single most important institution shaping Western culture is the university. It is at the university that our future political leaders, our journalists, our lawyers, our teachers, our business executives, our artists will be trained. It is at the university that they will formulate or, more likely, simply absorb the worldview that will shape their lives. And since these are the opinion makers and the leaders who shape our culture, the worldview that they imbibe at the university will be the one that shapes our culture. If we change the university, we change our culture through those who shape culture. If the Christian worldview can be restored to a place of prominence and respect at the university, it will have a leavening effect throughout all of society. Now, why is this important? It is important simply because the gospel is never heard in isolation. It is always heard against the background of a cultural milieu in which one lives. A person raised in a cultural milieu in which Christianity is still seen as intellectually viable will display an openness to the gospel which a person who is secularized will not. For the secular person, you may as well tell him to believe in fairies or leprechauns as to believe in Jesus Christ. Or, to give a more realistic illustration, it's like a devotee of the Hare Krishna movement approaching you on a street and inviting you to believe in Krishna. Such an invitation strikes us as bizarre, freakish, even amusing. But to a person on the streets of Bombay, such an invitation would, I think, appear quite reasonable and cause for serious reflection. I fear that evangelicals appear almost as weird to persons on the streets of Bonn, Stockholm, and Paris as do the devotees of Krishna. It is for this reason that Christians who depreciate the value of apologetics because, quote, nobody comes to Christ through intellectual arguments, end quote, are so short-sighted. For the value of apologetics extends far beyond one's immediate evangelistic contact. It is the broader task of Christian apologetics to help create and sustain a cultural milieu in which the gospel can be heard as an intellectually viable alternative for thinking men and women. The great Princeton theologian J. Gresham Machen rightly declared, "False ideas are the greatest obstacles to the reception of the gospel. We may preach with all the fervor of a reformer and yet succeed only in winning a straggler here and there if we permit the whole collective thought of the nation to be controlled by ideas which prevent Christianity from being regarded as anything more than a harmless delusion. Under such circumstances," said Machen, "what God desires us to do is to destroy the obstacle at its root. The root of the obstacle is to be found in the university, and it is there that it must be attacked." But that implies that popular-level apologetics aimed at the masses will not do the job. Only scholarly-level apologetics aimed at specialists in the various academic disciplines will be capable of changing the university, and so ensuring lasting cultural change. Machen observed that many people, quote, "would have the seminary's combat error as it is taught by its popular exponents. Instead of confusing students with a lot of German names unknown outside the walls of the university," end quote. But Machen insisted that the scholarly method of procedure is based simply upon a profound belief in the pervasiveness of ideas. What is today a matter of academic speculation begins tomorrow to move armies and pull down empires. In that second stage, says Machen, it has gone too far to be combated. The time to stop it was when it was still a matter of impassionate debate. So as Christians, he says, we should try to mold the thought of the world in such a way as to make the acceptance of Christianity something more than a logical absurdity. And thus, paradoxically, the most effective books in apologetics are not really books on apologetics at all. Rather, they will be books like Alvin Plantinga's book, The Nature of Necessity, Thomas Morris's The Logic of God Incarnate, and Colin Heimer's The Book of Acts in the Setting of Hellenistic History. So what, we may ask, are European evangelicals doing to win the scholarly debate and so change the university? Well, frankly, the answer must be very little indeed. With the notable exception of Great Britain, and to a lesser extent Germany, Europe has produced few distinguished evangelical scholars. What evangelical scholars there are tend to be big fish in a very small pond. Their influence extends very little beyond the evangelical subculture. They teach, for the most part, at evangelical Bible schools and seminaries instead of at the universities. They tend to publish with evangelical presses so that their works remain largely unread by non-evangelical scholars. And instead of participating in the standard professional societies, they shun these in favor of evangelical conferences. As a result, their light is put under a bushel, and they have little leavening effect for the sake of the gospel in their professional fields. And the deadening effect of secularism on the culture at large goes unchecked. We desperately need in Europe evangelical scholars who can compete with secular scholars on their own terms of scholarship. Charles Malik, the former Lebanese ambassador to the United States, in his address at the inauguration of the Billy Graham Center at Wheaton College, warned American Christians of the danger of anti-intellectualism. He asked pointedly, and I quote, Who among evangelicals can stand up to the great secular scholars on their own terms of scholarship? Who among evangelical scholars is quoted as a normative source by the greatest secular authorities on history or philosophy or psychology or sociology or politics? Does the evangelical mode of thinking have the slightest chance of becoming the dominant mode in the great universities of Europe and America that stamp our entire civilization with their spirit and ideas? Malik went on to say, it will take a different spirit altogether to overcome this great danger of anti-intellectualism. For example, I say this different spirit, so far as philosophy alone, the most important domain for thought and intellect, is concerned, must see the tremendous value of spending an entire year doing nothing but poring intensely over the Republic or the Sophist of Plato, or 2 years over the metaphysics or the ethics of Aristotle, or 3 years over the City of God of Augustine. But if a start is made now on a crash program in this and other domains, it will take at least a century to catch up with the Harvards and the Tübingens and the Sorbonne. And by then, where will these universities be? For the sake of greater effectiveness in witnessing to Jesus Christ, as well as for their own sakes, evangelicals cannot afford to keep on living on the periphery of responsible intellectual existence. These words hit like a hammer. European evangelicals, like their American brethren, have, for the most part, been living on the periphery of responsible intellectual existence. If the university, and as a consequence, European culture, is to be changed, then European evangelicals need to re-engage intellectually. It can be done. For example, over the last 40 years, there has been an ongoing revolution in the Anglo-American world in the field of philosophy. Since the late 1960s, Christian philosophers have been coming out of the closet and defending the truth of the Christian worldview with philosophically sophisticated arguments in the finest secular journals and secular professional societies. And the face of Anglo-American philosophy has been transformed as a result. 50 years ago, philosophers widely regarded talk about God as literally meaningless, as mere gibberish. But today, no informed philosopher could take such a viewpoint. In fact, many of America's finest philosophers today are outspoken Christians. Now, to give you some feel for the impact of this revolution, I want to quote at length from an article which just appeared last fall in the philosophy journal Philo, lamenting what the author called, quote, the desecularization of academia that evolved in philosophy departments since the late 1960s, end quote. The author, Quentin Smith, who is himself a prominent atheist philosopher at the University of Western Michigan, writes as follows. By the second half of the 20th century, universities had become in the main secularized. The standard position in each field assumed or involved arguments for a naturalist worldview. Departments of theology or religion aimed to understand the meaning and origins of religious writings, not to develop arguments against naturalism. Analytic philosophers treated theism as an anti-realist or non-cognitivist worldview, requiring the reality not of a deity, but merely of emotive expressions or certain forms of life. This is not to say that none of the scholars in the various academic fields were realist theists in their private lives, but realist theists, for the most part, excluded their theism from their publications and teaching, in large part because theism was mainly considered to have such low epistemic status that it did not meet the standards of an academically respectable position to hold. That was the tenor, the attitude in American academia in the 1960s. He says the secularization of mainstream academia began to quickly unravel upon the publication of Plantinga's influential book, God and Other Minds, in 1967. It became apparent to the philosophical profession that this book displayed that realist theists were not outmatched by naturalists in terms of the most valued standards of analytic philosophy: conceptual precision, rigor of argumentation, technical erudition, and an in-depth defense of an original worldview. This book, followed 7 years later by Plantinga's even more impressive book, The Nature of Necessity, made it manifest that a realist theist was writing at the highest qualitative level of analytic philosophy, on the same playing field as Carnap, Russell, Moore, Grunbaum, and other naturalists. Naturalists passively watched as realist versions of theism, most influenced by Plantinga's writings, began to sweep through the philosophical community. Until today, perhaps one quarter or one third of philosophy professors are theists, with most being Orthodox Christians. Although many theists do not work in the area of philosophy of religion, so many of them do work in this area that there are now over 5 philosophy journals devoted to theism or the philosophy of religion, such as Faith and Philosophy, Religious Studies, International Journal for Philosophy of Religion, Sophia, Philosophia Christi, and so forth. Philosophia Christi, of which this is an exemplar, he says, began in the late 1990s and is already overflowing with submissions from leading philosophers. Theists in other fields tend to compartmentalize their theistic beliefs from their scholarly work. They rarely assume and never argue for theism in their scholarly work. If they did, they would be committing academic suicide. Or more exactly, their articles would quickly be rejected. But, he says, in philosophy, it became almost overnight academically respectable to argue for theism, making philosophy a favored field of entry for the most intelligent and talented theists entering academia today. A count would show that in Oxford University Press's 2000-2001 catalog, there are 96 recently published books on the philosophy of religion. By contrast, there are 28 books on the philosophy of language, 23 on epistemology, including religious epistemology, such as Plantinga's warranted Christian belief, 14 on metaphysics, and so forth. Smith concludes, God is not dead in academia. He returned to life in the late 1960s and is now alive and well in his last academic stronghold, philosophy departments. This is the testimony of a prominent atheist philosopher to the change that has taken place before his eyes in Anglo-American philosophy. Now, I think he's probably exaggerating when he estimates that one quarter to one third of American philosophers are theists. But what his estimates do reveal is the perceived impact of Christian philosophers upon this field. Like Gideon's army, a committed minority of activists can have an impact far out of proportion to their actual numbers. The principal error that Quentin Smith makes in his article, I think, is calling philosophy departments God's last stronghold at the university. On the contrary, philosophy departments are not God's last stronghold. They are a beachhead from which operations can be launched to impact other disciplines at the university for Christ. Indeed, I think we are already seeing the spillover effect into other areas like the natural sciences, where a flourishing dialogue between science and religion is going on, and proponents of so-called intelligent design are making waves. The point is that the task of desecularization is not hopeless or impossible, nor need significant changes take so long to achieve as one might think. It is this sort of Christian scholarship which represents the best hope for the transformation that Malik and Machen envisioned, and its true impact for the cause of Christ will only be felt, I believe, in the next generation as it filters down into popular culture. Now, I've said all of this concerning the challenge that confronts us. What advice, then, might I give to those whom God has burdened with the awesome task of becoming Christian apologists in Europe? Let me be very practical. Number one, you must master the English language. For better or worse, the simple fact is that most of the apologetically significant literature today is in English. Moreover, some of this literature is highly technical and is difficult to read even for a native speaker. The writings of Alvin Plantinga are an especially significant resource. If your English is weak, then vast amounts of important work will be closed to you. So you must master English to do apologetics well. Probably the best thing you can do to improve your English is to spend several months studying in an Anglophone country. For Europeans, Great Britain is the obvious choice. Look into opportunities to study, perhaps during a summer, at a British university or college. Number two, you need to take a strong dose of analytic philosophy. The kind of philosophy that predominates in the Anglophone world is known as analytic philosophy. This style of philosophizing contrasts sharply with that of continental philosophy. Whereas continental philosophy tends to be obscure, imprecise, and emotive, analytic philosophy lays great worth and emphasis on clarity of definitions, careful delineation of premises, and logical rigor of argumentation. Unfortunately, theology has tended to follow the lead of continental philosophy, which only results in darkness being piled upon darkness. The experience of the last 40 years in the Renaissance of Anglo-American philosophy of religion has revealed that important philosophical issues can be brilliantly illuminated through philosophical analysis. Richard Swinburne, the Noleth Professor of the Philosophy of the Christian Religion at Oxford University, has written, "It is one of the intellectual tragedies of our age that when philosophy in English-speaking countries has developed high standards of argument and clear thinking, the style of theological writing has been largely influenced by continental philosophy of existentialism, which, despite its considerable other merits, has been distinguished by a very loose and sloppy style of argument. If argument has a place in theology, large-scale theology needs clear and rigorous argument." That point was very well grasped by Thomas Aquinas and Duns Scotus, by Berkeley, Butler, and Paley. It is high time for theology to return to their standards. By employing the high standards of reasoning characteristic of analytic philosophy, we can powerfully formulate apologetic arguments for both commending and defending the Christian worldview. In recent decades, analytic philosophers of religion have shed new light on the rationality and warrant of religious belief, on arguments for the existence of God, on divine attributes such as necessity, eternity, omnipotence, omniscience, and goodness, on the problem of suffering and evil, on the nature of the soul and immortality, on the problem of miracles, and even on peculiarly Christian doctrines like the Trinity, incarnation, atonement, original sin, revelation, hell, and prayer. I simply cannot describe for you the wealth of material that is out there that has been produced by analytic philosophers of religion. If you want to do apologetics effectively, you need to be trained in analytic philosophy. And I say this even if your area of specialization is not philosophical apologetics. Suppose you choose to specialize in scientific or historical apologetics. The fact is that some of the most important issues you will confront will be questions arising from philosophy of science or epistemology. Over and over again, I see scientists and New Testament scholars making faulty inferences or proceeding from unexamined presuppositions because of their philosophical naivete. Whatever your area of specialization, you will be better equipped as an apologist if you've had some training in analytic philosophy. You can begin by taking a course or working through a textbook on first-order logic and then second-order logic as well. Then work through a textbook on modal logic, the logic of possibility and necessity. There are also good introductions to analytic philosophy, which you can consult. Finally, begin to read Analytic Philosophy of Religion, a good beginning text. Applying the insights of analytic philosophy to apologetics is Reason for the Hope Within, edited by Michael Murray. This book consists of essays by a group of young Christian philosophers applying their philosophical expertise to various areas of the Christian faith. A good reference tool is Philip Quinn and Charles Tolliver's book, A Companion to Philosophy of Religion, published by Blackwell. You might also consult articles in the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, published by Routledge. There is an abundance of fine anthologies in philosophy of religion. For example, the Reader and Guide that I just recently edited for Edinburgh University Press, entitled Philosophy of Religion. Number three, earn a doctorate in your area of specialization. This may not come as welcome advice. But brothers and sisters, popular apologetics alone will not do the job. Popular apologetics may sway the uneducated, but it will not change the prevailing thought structures of society. In order to transform the culture, we must change the university. In order to change the university, we must do scholarly apologetics. In order to do scholarly apologetics, we must earn doctorates. It's that simple. It will not be easy. The power structures at European universities are often deeply anti-Christian. Students who are evangelical Christians will be weeded out by denying them degrees or professorships. There will be, and already have been, victims of anti-Christian discrimination in the process. Such fallen brethren are truly intellectual martyrs for the faith of, for the cause of Christ, and my heart breaks for them. But over time, more and more of us will successfully get through. In the United States, graduate programs in philosophy are awash with Christian students, gradually working their way up through the system. As the old guard dies off, and young Christian philosophers are hired in their places, the face of the university will change. What Thomas Kuhn said of scientific revolutions is also true of Christian revolutions. They proceed one funeral at a time. It can happen in Europe. Be patient. Be persistent. Be prayerful. Change will come. Now, I realize that for some of you, the opportunity for doctoral study has passed you by. In your case, I'd encourage you to be on the lookout for younger students whom you can direct into doctoral programs. But if you're under 35 years of age, that opportunity is still a realistic option, which I'd encourage you to explore. The keys for success will be, first, choosing a doctoral thesis topic which you're passionate about. And second, finding a mentor at a secular university who is at least sympathetic to your thesis topic. You may have to write on a more neutral topic than you'd like in order not to arouse opposition to your candidacy. For example, my doctoral thesis on the resurrection of Jesus at the Universität München was primarily a history of historical apologetics for the resurrection. Once I had the degree safely in hand, then I published the hundreds of pages I had written on my own historical apologetic for the resurrection of Jesus as a second volume. And I hope and I pray that many of you folks here this morning will seriously consider going on for doctoral work in some specialized field as part of your training for your apologetic calling. Number four, be mindful of your personal spiritual formation. Quite honestly, I'm not always enthusiastic when I meet a student who tells me that he wants to be a Christian apologist. One sometimes detects that what the student really wants is the limelight and the glory, or there may be a spirit of argumentativeness or arrogance about him, or perhaps a craving for the affirmation of others in order to offset a personal sense of inferiority. Now, of course, we're all broken people, and none of us has motives that are wholly pure. But it's vitally important that as a public representative of Christ, the Christian apologist be a person who goes often to his knees to spend time with God, who depends daily upon the filling of the Holy Spirit to lead a life pleasing and acceptable to God. He must seek Christ's glory, not his own. He must be open to criticism and willing to see his own shortcomings. If he is married, he must not place his ministry or his studies ahead of his family, but rather be prepared to give up his studies and his ministry, if necessary, for the sake of those he loves. He must guard against sin, especially sexual sin, in thought as well as in deed, so as not to dishonor Christ. He must learn what it means not merely to do things for God, but to be the person that God wants him to be. Unless we learn to be who God wants us to be, all our achievements will be as wood, hay, and stubble. Our spiritual formation is therefore as vitally important as our academic formation as Christian apologists. So in summary, my advice to you as European Christian apologist is, number one, master the English language. Two, take a strong dose of analytic philosophy. Three, earn a doctorate in your area of specialization. And four, be mindful of your personal spiritual formation. I would also encourage you to become a part of a community of like-minded scholars. For the last 3 years, I have served as the president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society, a recently revitalized society of evangelical philosophers. Our membership now tops 1,100 people. And our journal, which I mentioned earlier, Philosophia Christi, is the only evangelical journal of philosophy in the world, and it is emerging as one of the leading journals in the philosophy of religion. It is a tremendous resource for those who are involved in Christian apologetics. And I've put some exemplars here on the table for some of you, if you care to have a look at these issues to see if this might be of help to you. Especially helpful, I think, is the extensive book review section in each issue, which reviews current literature in philosophy of religion, apologetics, historical Jesus. And I would urge you to consider becoming a part of the Evangelical Philosophical Society. I have some brochures here, as well as membership blanks, which I've left on the table, and you can avail yourself of these during the break. But I think being part of such a like-minded community of evangelical philosophers and apologists would be of a tremendous help and encouragement to you. I believe that Europe can be changed, and I'm excited about the stirrings of a new movement, which I sense that is happening in Europe. This conference is but one indication of that new movement that God is raising up. May God raise up a mighty force of committed men and women to transform the European university and hence European culture in such a way that the gospel may be heard afresh in all its life-changing power.
Thank you so much. I think we will do like this, that we take some few minutes in small groups, three or four persons as we sit in the room, just to formulate our reactions on the lecture, our comments, our questions, what we did not understood or agree with, and so on. Especially for us who has not English as our first language, so we have a chance to sort our thoughts out and formulate ourselves.
Mics, right? One for taping and one for...
One for the... Yeah.
Okay.
So you just lead it from here.
All right. Yeah. Sure. Okay, yes, back here. Oh, wait, let's be quiet here so we can hear the question, please.
I really appreciate your emphasis on scholarship and encouraging us to get off of joyful, responsible intellectual existence. My question is, what do you say of continental thinkers like Paul Ricoeur, Hans-Georg Gadamer, Emmanuel Levinas, or Charles Taylor's work in North America, who would all be considered continental philosophers, who are not modernists, or naturalists, or rationalists, but they're either postmodernists, as you characterize postmodernism? I mean, in other words, is continental philosophy bankrupt totally, in your opinion?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Is there something that's
right.
Possibly
the question was, is continental philosophy totally bankrupt, or is there something redeemable there? I'm not suggesting that it's totally bankrupt. I have some friends who do specialize in continental work, but my experience has just been that in terms of its value for Christian apologetics, I don't think that it's nearly as valuable as good training in analytic thought. So I personally don't find it profitable to spend time reading or studying the figures that you mentioned. Instead, I find that in the limited time that we have available and that I have available, that time is better invested in reading analytic philosophy of religion. I find it far more helpful in illuminating Christian doctrine and in helping with Christian apologetics than I have found what little I've read in continental thought. If you do feel a burden to work within continental philosophy, that's great, and I don't want to discourage you from doing that. But I think that for most of us who are interested in Christian apologetics, I think that you'll find just vastly greater resources in the analytic school of thinking.
But if
Matt's?
If if the society where we live draws from continental philosophy all the time, mm-hmm. I mean, then we kind of have to...
Right. The question was, but don't we, if we live in a society that draws from continental thinking, then don't we have to blank? And the question wasn't finished. But the I think how do you finish that question? The answer to that would be you don't have to therefore absorb and utilize that style of thinking in your apologetic. That would be something you would respond to, but you would do so using the resources and the training in analytic philosophy. And I think that part of the best antidote to some of the obscurity and unclarity in continental thought is good, clear, logical, analytic thinking, analysis of concepts, clear delineation of arguments, and so forth. So the analytic style of philosophizing and thinking will help you to interact with these currents of continental thought that you find washing about you. Yes?
I would say I'm saying for everything you know, what we are doing now in our part of the world is quite reflects the strategy. I am concerned not about what we are doing, but about what we are not doing. See? Like, investing most of efforts in academia, it's long-term investment.
Right.
Yeah, but the problem is academia is also subculture, which is quite isolated from the majority of the culture. And so while we are thinking about long-term projects, the majority, 80 to 90% population who are not involved in the culture are still be pagan, Gentile, who needs Jesus now. And only the strongholds they got from their high school's education not allow them to accept the truth. What would be your advice
The question was, this is a long-term strategy that I've laid out, but what about in the short term? What about the 80 to 90% that are outside of academia that need help right now? You're absolutely right in what you said about the strategy I've laid out. Mine is a long-term strategy, though my experience in the Anglophone world suggests that it isn't as long-term as one might think, that within a few decades one can make an enormous impact, such as has happened over the last 40 years in the Anglo-American realm. But it is a long-term strategy. I'm not sure what to say about the short-term strategy. I think probably that's where I would listen to you. I think other people here would have perhaps better ideas for short-term strategies. But I just think that that's where the emphasis has always been, is on the short term, and that's why we need to raise our eyes to a higher level and think more in terms of long-term strategies. That's been my burden and what I wanted to share. I don't think there's any shortcoming or any lack of short-term strategies. There are plenty of people talking about that. I'm more concerned with long-term, long-lasting cultural change because, frankly, I don't think that these short-term strategies are going to be as effective as they could be without long-term change. We always talk about let's adopt creative new strategies, let's do new things to bring the gospel to our culture. But you see, if the basic cultural milieu in which those short-term strategies are offered is a cultural milieu in which believing in Jesus is like believing in fairies or leprechauns, those short-term strategies just won't be effective. So I'm wanting us to begin to stop thinking, or not stop, but to not just think about short-term strategies and start thinking more in terms of the long-term. Because it's only the long-term, I think, that will help to make the short-term strategies more effective. So I guess that's a way of saying I don't have any huge opinions about short-term strategies. My concern is in a different place. Yes?
One of the particular issues we face in the United Kingdom is that within evangelicalism itself, and not just in some sort of small old guard, but resurgently, there is a view that apologetics is basically a waste of time.
Yes.
Because people's thinking is darkened, and the only thing that will therefore work is to preach the gospel to them. And so it'll actually quite a lot of work within evangelicalism to persuade people that this is important. how would you kind of advise us to go about that task?
The question was, we are often unappreciated as Christian apologists by our own Christian brethren and churches. And how would one go about convincing them of the value of what we're doing? I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's part of the mentality that a Christian apologist needs to develop is that you don't expect to be appreciated. I think that that's absolutely crucial. You must expect to be non-appreciated. Don't be looking for people coming to you and saying, oh, we need what you have, you're wonderful. We need to love the church as a body that doesn't know how desperately sick she is and how much she needs us. Do you see what I mean? It's like a doctor trying to cure someone of a disease when that person doesn't think he has the disease. And you don't do it because you're appreciated by the church or because the church thinks that what you're doing is important. You do it in spite of that. So it is often a thankless task, and I think we need to approach it with that mentality. Otherwise, we'll grow discouraged and get burned out, and we'll quit doing it. We need to expect it to be a thankless job. But having said that, I think that one of the best ways to do this with our brethren would be through the use of adult Sunday school classes and evening fellowship groups in our homes. I've done this in our home church back in the United States. I teach a Sunday school class after the morning service. And I find that a minority of people who are very, very excited about apologetics just love coming to this class, and they just can't get enough of it. They just drink it up like water on a dry ground. So that you won't get a large mass of people, but you will work with that committed minority. And what's significant about that is that committed minority will often be the brightest and the best people in the church. It will be people whose minds are engaged, who are going to be the movers and shakers. So don't be concerned if you don't have large numbers. Work with the quality of the individuals you have and begin to teach them things like Christian doctrine and apologetics and evidence for the resurrection, evidence for the existence of God, how to respond to objections and so forth. And you can also do this, as I say, in your home. Say, like, have a Tuesday night fellowship group in your home where you'll read through a book, an apologetics book, like, say, Know Why You Believe or Scaling the Secular City or something like that, and discuss it. And my experience is that once lay people get a taste of this, they really get hooked on it. They really come alive because it begins to answer all of these questions that they've been suppressing and trying to keep at bay, or these questions that non-Christian people have that they're afraid to answer because they don't know the answers. So I think that you can do it in that way, and I have found personally that lay people are very, very responsive. A minority of them are very, very responsive to apologetics if you share it in a simple way. So I would try Sunday school classes and home fellowship groups. Go over to this side. Yes.
First is, how do you reconcile 1 Corinthians 1 and 2, where Paul talks about the wisdom of God over the wisdom of the world? I'm curious to know how you interact that with your very good argument today.
Yeah.
And the second is, you know, if I were God, I would convert people in academia, like I converted Saul to Paul.
Right.
And he had the background, he had the history, he had the knowledge, he had the ability. We're talking long-term solution here, but it's a speculative question. But the point is that God could easily convert 5 great European academics and, like C.S. Lewis, have an impact on the world. So can you comment on those two?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the second question is. I think maybe God will do that. Yeah, right. Yeah, it is a question. You know, really, it's a version of the problem of evil, is what you're asking, is why doesn't God intervene to do this miraculous thing that we think would rectify a great evil, namely all the unbelief in academia? Well, God is doing this. There's Alvin Plantinga, there's Robert Adams, there's William Alston, George Mavrides. I could just name scores of first-rate philosophers who are Christians today. And he will do it in Europe too, I believe. He may call out somebody from this group who will become a great Christian philosopher or academic. So God will do it. I trust that he will. Now, in answer to the first question, you should talk to the guy two seats from you. Lorsch, didn't you write your thesis on this topic of
Act 17, yes.
Yeah, so he talked to him about that question, because he knows about this. But I would say, and Lorsch could correct me if I'm wrong here, I think what Paul is combating in 1 Corinthians 2 is not wisdom as such or reason as such, but it's a kind of Gnosticizing wisdom that sees enlightenment as the means by which one gets to God, rather than the cross of Jesus Christ. And he says the cross of Christ is folly to those who think that through Gnostic mysteries and the penetration of mysteries and mystical knowledge, one can find a path to God. And I think Paul quite rightly does reject that kind of wisdom as being antithetical to the cross. And so, for example, in Colossians, he also says, see to it that no one makes a prey of you by philosophy and empty deceit according to human wisdom, according to the elemental spirits of the universe and not according to Christ. So I think what Paul's rejecting there is not reason as such, but this kind of Gnosticizing use of reason. Yes, this gentleman here in the blue shirt.
I come from Romania, and while I understand very well that in the Anglophile world, as you call it, Anglo-Saxon world, you are able to regain the philosophy, I think that part of that for Christianity, part of that success is due to the fact that the Anglo-Saxon world is able to understand an evangelical or at least Protestant discourse.
Yes.
Yeah. I come from an Orthodox country, and one of the biggest problems is that even a Christian evangelical discourse is not understood by the other people, 90% who claim to be Christians.
Yeah.
So the task of apologetics is compounded. What I mean by this is in England, I studied in England or in America, most of the people, even in their day-by-day language, even if they are closely to being secular, understand Christian talk. They may not yeah. understand what you mean yeah. exactly, but they understand Christian talk.
Right.
In Romania, and I assume it's true for Russia, Ukraine, maybe for Poland, although that's more Catholic, but it's also in the same kind of
yes.
mold, when you talk evangelical, it triggers. Evangelical talk triggers
yeah.
in the discourse, in the national discourse, warning signs which are set there by their background.
Yeah.
So you're not fighting an atheistic mindset necessarily. So how would you approach this in developing an apologetic discourse, which would be both tenable to the majority church, because we are comfortable in our minority, in our ghetto.
Yeah.
But that's not the point.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a really profound and interesting question that I don't have the experience to answer. Let me repeat the question. It was, for those who are working in Orthodox countries, how can this use of apologetics be used within Orthodoxy, since the language of evangelicalism is not that of the Orthodox? Let me just say two things that might be helpful here. One would be, is I think you could go back beyond evangelicalism to the Church Fathers and begin to read people like Basil of Caesarea and Gregory of Nyssa and Gregory Nazianzus, who are the great champions of Orthodoxy, and appropriate the philosophical and theological insights from those fathers. That will, I think
many evangelicals in America have done that and have turned to Orthodoxy.
Yes, that's right. Well, this is absolutely right. One of my colleagues at Talbot, John Mark Reynolds, who is the head of the philosophy department at the undergraduate institution, is Orthodox, and yet he's an analytic philosopher. The other fellow, and this was the second point that I was going to mention, is that Richard Swinburne, the Noleth professor at Oxford, converted to Orthodoxy. So that Swinburne's also Orthodox. So that would be, again, a point of tangents or a point of connection. If somebody like Richard Swinburne, who is an analytic philosopher par excellence, can also be Orthodox, there's clearly not a perceived incompatibility there. So I would try to perhaps use Swinburne's work as a bridge to Orthodoxy. See, this man is an Orthodox Christian philosopher. And then use his philosophical work. So I think that these illustrations suggest that however the task is to be done, it's by no means an impossible task. These aren't incompatible with each other. because others are doing it. So I would suggest looking at their work. Yes?
I have a couple of questions, and I think they're related. I really appreciated your passionate plea for scholarship and for scholarly rigor. However, I felt that you dismissed continental philosophy and romantic themes far too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you an example. I hold discussion groups of students that I teach at my home, and we got into a fairly impassioned debate about the use of tarot cards as being able to show us something about ourselves, whether that's a legitimate use of, whether that's a legitimate means to self-knowledge or not. It seems to me that if I had presented her an analytical argument that shows her that that's incoherent, that's sort of missing the boat. It would be completely irrelevant for her, where she is, for this student. Rather, she is resonating to the themes that Romanticism and continental philosophy move from. That is, a unity of subject and object, of self with world, of these grand themes that continental philosophy deals with. And I believe that it's possible to have a Christian discourse, to assume Christian mm-hmm. presuppositions, and argue from within that sort of discourse. So that's the first point. Second point is, reading from the success of analytic philosophy and Christian discourse in American and English philosophy departments to saying this can be a beachhead and everybody else can do the same thing in your own department, just use analytic discourse and you'll get there, I think misreads the variety of departments and departmental discourses at work in the university. One of the fields that I'm most interested in is cultural studies. Logic is part of that discourse, of course, but it's by no means the most important. Far more important is political engagement, that I'm actually dealing with these political sort of neo-Marxist themes.
Mm-hmm.
In that sort of context, an argument for Christian spirituality, and especially one that comes off as very precise and chopping up your rows of carrots so that they are well defined, would come off as sounding bizarre and strange.
Mm-hmm.
I think rather you need to take the common grace, you know, those elements of truth from within that discourse, and argue those can only be accessed. Those can only be done from Christian presuppositions, that it is possible, rather than saying to all the departments in the university, please come speak my language because my language is the right one.
Mm-hmm.
Instead saying, I'm going to speak your language and I'm going to show you the legitimacy, the credibility, the relevance of a Christian worldview from within your own discursive practice.
Yeah, if that can be done, that's the question. I mean, what you're raising here is this knotty problem of pragmatism and truth. I mean, I've often wondered, should I share with, or is it right to share with someone an argument that you know they would find effective in persuading them, even though you yourself don't think it's a very good argument? You know, to me, that seems illicit. That doesn't seem right to me. That if I think that something is, say, an invalid argument, I wouldn't try to convince someone to believe in Christ or God, even if I knew that pragmatically that would be effective with him, if I think this argument really is invalid. So the question here is a question of truth, ultimately. And I think we mustn't ever sacrifice truth for effectiveness. Now, I'm not suggesting that you're saying we should, but that's the question you're going to need to raise, is whether or not, for example, in dealing with this young lady in the tarot cards, you know, you're going to sacrifice truth in order to find something that moves her because she's moved by talk about no difference between the object and the subject and the identity of the self and the world. I mean, when I hear those kind of buzzwords, to me, that just shouts pantheism and mysticism, and it doesn't sound at all to me like a Christian world and life view. This sounds to me to be compromising on Christian truth, and I don't think we should compromise truth to be effective. Now, with respect to these other disciplines and languages, when I talk about analytic philosophy, I think that one is talking here about something that is a God-given endowment of this part of the Imago Dei, part of the image of God and man, namely that as God is the supreme Logos, John says, in the beginning was the Logos, the Word, and the Word was with God, the Word was God. God is the supremely rational entity, and our reason and logic is a reflection of the mind of God himself, so that as creatures created in the image of God, we exalt and magnify God when we think logically and correctly and use reason. And therefore, I think this is divine in a sense. It's a reflection of the divine image of God in man when we use the canons of logic and rationality. And we shouldn't sacrifice these out of a pragmatic desire to speak to our culture or to win people. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't contextualize what we want to say. And I think this is what you're really probably saying, is that having got my Christian truth package here, now I can ask, how can I couch this in such a way that it will connect with the people I want to reach? And obviously, you have to do that. I mean, obviously, you're going to have to present it in a way that will hook up with your audience. But nevertheless, behind that, like the iceberg below the surface of the water, there's got to be a clear understanding of the premises that are involved in your apologetic, the logical relationship between those premises. You need to have a clear understanding of the concepts you're talking about, because if you don't have all of those, it's just incoherence, and you're not doing anybody any favor to share incoherent things with them. So you don't need to present it in the same way that you understand it. Very often in my debates, I will try to present things in such a way that they are winsome and relevant and will hook in with people. But behind that, concealed, as it were, back here, are the hours spent in the study developing careful arguments and analysis and so forth, although that isn't always put on parade, if you know what I mean. So don't think that I'm suggesting that analytic philosophy is the best tool for evangelism or anything like that. But I am suggesting that in terms of doing apologetics, it will be a very, very valuable asset in terms of formulating your arguments and in answering or formulating answers to objections and understanding Christian theology. Okay.
Thank you very, very much. We